Ross, I'm wondering about cinema going in the 90s. Having heard Ross's sort of explanation about it in the 30s, how has it changed and what kind of an experience do we have today?
Well, I think in a sense, things have changed enormously because of the way in which the mass media now work and the way in which the moving image is now presented to us in a variety of different places, no longer just the cinema. So I think the days of the movie palace, of the themed cathedral, these wonderful, enchanting places which we've been hearing about, I think, they've obviously gone and they're not going to come back. I think what's replaced that are a variety of different ways in which we engage with the image. And it's interesting to hear how all of the speakers are talking about the experience of going to the cinema. And in a sense, the experience of going to the cinema is no longer about that prelude, the place of the cinema. It's about the experience of the image. And if you look at the history of the transformation of cinemas and the transformation of technologies of the moving image, you can see, for example, when television was introduced, that this also corresponds with the introduction of widescreen formats, of new cinemas which would present Cinerama, the first of the commercially successful widescreen formats. And I think that we see a continuation of this into the present. So, for example, the IMAX large format theatres, which are produced by IMAX, companies like iWorks, Mega Systems, and so on, these are again on the rise. And what is spectacular about these places is not so much the architecture surrounding them, although I think that that's interesting as well, but it's the spectacle of the image and the experience. So all the promotion tells us anyway, the experience of the image there is so much different. It's the largest screen in the world. It's 8 stories high. We see the image projected on 70 mil film and so on. I think that's one tendency. So we've got the grand, spectacular image which large format cinema gives us. On the other hand, I think we've got what you could call the fragmentation of the image, or I suppose it's more a commercial adaptation of the image to all these different places. So I think if you look at the way in which big spectacle films are now produced and then marketed and where they appear, they don't just appear on the cinema screens, they appear as computer games, they appear on television, they appear as merchandising, they appear in comics and so on. They also appear in amusement park formats. And one of the things that I think is developing quite rapidly at the moment is the idea of the cinema as an amusement park, as a ride. So there are a number of companies who are making ride simulators where you might have a very small theatrical experience, anything from 8 to say maybe 100 maximum, where the image, of course, stays in the same place, but people are moved in time with the motion of the image. And I think that ride simulation films are changing the way in which films will be presented in the future. I think it also corresponds with a development of what's often referred to as location-based entertainment. It's kind of the Darling Harbour experience. It's the Universal Walk at Universal City in Los Angeles. It's the idea of creating an environment which is a commercial environment, a place where the image can be resold as a product, and then you go and re-experience the image somewhere else. So I think what's interesting is the way in which architecture is responding to this fragmentation of the image.
Brian, you've looked at a few cinemas complexes overseas. Can you enlighten us, tell us a little bit about some of those experiences? You were talking about one in LA.
I was also just reflecting on the last speaker's talk, because I've been to Cinemagic down in Darling Harbour and I absolutely love it. I mean, it's meant to be for 13 to sort of 16-year-old boys, I think, as the core market, but I don't know how they're doing. But I just love it, you know. I mean, it's a visceral step into reality, and it's in a way irrelevant, the auditorium that you're in. It's the engagement with the image and the sense of actually being on a luge ride or being a pinball in a pinball game. I think there's always going to be the kind of sort of thrills and spills activities, and the cinema's always brought these to us first, I think. It's always actually sort of been the big canvas on which the, you know, the next frontier is exposed. And everyone's watching to see, you know, to what extent the IMAX format will actually become the new narrative format for storytelling. It's all been about cost, really. I mean, I think they're now saying in 3 to 4 years we'll see full feature length, you know, widely distributed, providing there are exhibition facilities to do so. But I mean, we now have them in all cities, all major cities in Australia, and they've just opened one in Auckland or about to. So, you know, the big picture, the seven stories high or whatever, that wraps you around and takes you somewhere, is not always going to be about, you know, climbing Mount Everest or going to the moon. It's actually going to be a narrative, and it's going to be long, and it's going to be satisfying, and it's going to have stars. So this is a brave new frontier, and it doesn't really matter terribly much anymore what sort of building you're doing it in. Preferably it's in a black box. It's just really what we've come to. But I was very interested to find recently information on the internet, having read an article in a magazine, about the American Cinematheque in Los Angeles, and that's a particularly inspiring project when you're wrestling with the issues of how do you make a heritage building that has an obvious number of restrictions on it in terms of its preservation, how do you make it live into the future as a facility? And I wouldn't preface what I'm about to say as being something that, you know, I envisage will in fact happen to the state, because I think we have a number of limitations which override what has been achieved in Los Angeles. But essentially, Grauman's Egyptian Theatre, which was built in 1922 and premiered Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments silent film, has had a very checkered history, some of it in disuse, in disrepair, recently damaged seriously by the earthquake. But one way or another, it's now found a new life. It's been through Cinerama, it's been through, you know, it's been through everything. But it's now, after some years of dereliction, now become the permanent home of the American Cinematheque. And they have adapted its interior for the purposes of modern cinema presentation. And they have, I think, a maximum seating in the auditorium for their normal or subscriber showings, if you like, or member showings, of about 800, I think. Whereas it was originally a 2,000-seat theatre on two levels and richly decorated, mainly in plaster, with the inspired Egyptian decor, which was inspired, you know, the early part of the 1920s by the discovery of Tutankhamun's treasure. But they had certain advantages in that the proscenium had been removed because of the installation of Cinerama in the late 50s. But what they essentially are able to do there is display the heritage interior, including a shortened version of the balcony. But once you take your seats towards the front of the auditorium, you're in fact now seated somewhere across the what we call the curtain line and into the stage house area, because it did have a stage house, which is essentially a black box at one end now. And in a matter of minutes, they can actually wrap you in a modern theatre interior. It's automated, it's retrofitted to do so, and it envelops the 900 seats, and you get, you know, a state-of-the-art acoustic air-conditioned environment for modern cinema projection. And then after the session, it wraps away and disappears. So wouldn't that be fabulous? It was, you know, an expensive project, but of course, you know, the critical mass of Hollywood and the American population, you know, tends to make these things much more cost-effective ultimately. And it's a not-for-profit organisation, and it's not received any funds from anything other than, I think, the sort of what the equivalent of a Hollywood local council. But it's had some serious sponsorship from Steven Spielberg. So, to me, that just continues to speak alongside what's going on in the United States more than anywhere else, which is the constant preservation, restoration, and adaptation of heritage cinemas. I mean, they've got hundreds of them in the United States. They started off with many, many, many more than we had. But they, in the main, have been pushed into full lyric presentation mode of live theatre. The great expansion globally of copyrights by people like, you know, the composers of Les Mis and Miss Saigon and Andrew Lloyd Webber's catalogue has actually generated a lot of new use for old cinemas, usually by, you know, deepening the stage in most instances so that they could fit the dimensions of the touring productions. But it's been a great renaissance in terms of preservation and restoration. And we've seen it here in Australia too, not just in Sydney with the Capitol, but also in Melbourne with the Regent, less successfully, because it really it's a bit hamstrung by its acoustic and its actual interior dimensions. It's really too big, even for lyric musicals. The state has enormous potential for eventually a redevelopment behind its proscenium, and that's something that will come in time, but not too soon. But the actual sort of future of the state as a cinema, it's very much centres around the film festival's occupation for a couple of weeks, and maybe the half a dozen times a year that we actually do a premiere.